and literally all of the resources from, say, July 1940 until September or October were being sucked into making sure that Germany didn't invade England. So the U-boats ran wild. But it was an extraordinary episode because who would expect a submarine to surrender to aircraft? And the aircraft crews had to be commended for not giving in to the temptation of sinking the U-boat. So what they did was they started just having continuous aircraft flying over the area, making sure that all of the bay was covered by radar, because every time the Germans detected the radar, they would submerge.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Welcome to the latest episode of Extended, the ETOPS Aviation Podcast. We're ready for takeoff.
Welcome to Extended's Coastal Command series. I'm Gareth Stringer, and I'm your host for this third chapter. In this instalment, we look at the role played by RAF Coastal Command in the Battle for the Atlantic. Whilst the Battle of the Atlantic was multidimensional from a logistical perspective, this was also true from other aspects too, notably the technology used and the way in which it was fought. The role of RAF Coastal Command was, without doubt, a major contributory factor to the Allied success, and joining us to discuss this further is Mark Ladas. Mark holds a degree in Naval Architecture and Marine Engineering and spent his early career at the Johnson Space Center as a space navigator and as software engineer on the shuttle program. An amateur historian and longtime ship modeler, Mark is currently a freelance writer living in Texas and has written multiple books on naval and air history. Two of his books, published by Osprey, were on the air Battle for the Atlantic. Peter started the interview by asking Mark to explain the Battle for the Atlantic from his perspective.
Okay. The Battle of the Atlantic, in a broad sense, was the battle for the control of the waters around Great Britain. And in this case, it eventually stretched to the entire Atlantic Ocean. Coastal Command's task was to control those waters. Unfortunately, prior to World War II, everyone thought the main threat would be surface raiders. The U-boat was widely believed to be obsolete, and obsolete for a couple of reasons. The most important one was aircraft. During World War I, the primitive aircraft of the period pretty much shut down the U-boat campaign. And simply by being able to spot the U-boats and direct ships to them. Plus, you know, airplane attacking a U-boat wasn't a fair fight even in World War I. So from that standpoint, and the other problem for the U-boats was that the British had discovered or developed and deployed what they called ASDIC, what the United States would call sonar, which was a means of underwater detection of a submerged submarine. The combination of the two was felt to make the World War I style merchant campaign obsolete. And in large part, that view proved correct over the late war. The problem in the early war was it was kind of like the old joke about the mathematician who wakes up in his hotel room, sees the curtains on fire, sees a wastebasket, sees the bathtub and the water there, and says a solution exists, goes back to sleep and burns to death. The fact that the U-boat was obsolete required aircraft capable of sinking U-boats, and for a number of reasons, Coastal Command really didn't have that at the beginning of the war. Their main aircraft was a two-engine, fairly small aircraft called the Anson, and the Anson could only carry two 100-pound anti-submarine bombs. These were bombs that exploded on the surface. They were not depth charges. Furthermore, as the war went on, they discovered that these bombs were completely incapable of damaging a submarine. In an incident in late 1939, early 1940, an Anson spotted a submarine, dropped two of these bombs that scored a direct hit on the conning tower, and it turned out it wasn't a German U-boat, it was the British submarine Snapper, and the crew came home indignant that they had been bombed by Coastal Command, and what's more, the only damage the two bombs did was to burst four light bulbs inside the conning tower.
Okay.
You know, they essentially had a wooden sword.
Yeah.
Furthermore, all but one of the squadrons at the beginning of the war were equipped, all of the land-based squadrons, land aircraft squadrons at the beginning of the war were equipped with Ansons. One was transitioning to a plane called the Hudson, which could carry 200-pound bombs. The rest of them were various seaplanes, three of which were the modern Sunderland. The rest of them were various biplane flying boats, London, Stranraer, things like that. Those had been obsolete even leading up to the war. In the late 1930s, the biplane was being phased out, but that was most of the flying boats the British had. Now, they realized they had these problems, and they had contracted for three new aircraft, the twin-engine Botha, which was a land-based aircraft, the Beaufort as a torpedo bomber. The Botha was supposed to replace fill the role of the Anson. Beaufort was supposed to replace the biplane Wildebeest torpedo bombers, and then they had a twin-engine float plane, both the Botha and the Lerwick. Yeah. Turned out to be absolute disasters, the Lerwick in particular, which, if it lost an engine, could not maintain level flight and could not maintain a straight line. So if you lost an engine, you were doomed to wide descending circles, which made it pretty well useless. Coastal Command made up some of their deficits by purchasing from the United States, and in particular, they went to Lockheed in 1938 and got an airplane called the Hudson, which was derived from a twin-engine airliner that Lockheed had. They showed up at Lockheed asking for a trainer, and Lockheed said, well, you know, we could give you a maritime patrol airplane. And they did a mock-up literally overnight of what turned into the Hudson, which impressed the purchasing agency, and they and ordered them, and they were just coming online in 1939. But regardless, the only weapon the Coastal Command had that was capable of sinking a U-boat was the 400-pound depth charge, and only the Sunderlands could carry those.
Mark, what were the tactics that were used in those early years to attack U-boats? I mean, radar really wasn't online in those early years. It was a little bit hit and miss. The Mark I eyeball was, you know, your number one way of identifying U-boats. Yep. What were the tactics then that Coastal Command employed?
Well, that's actually a pretty good question, because basically what they were doing was flying patrols searching for U-boats. This was all daylight initially, and if they found one, they would attack it. Again, the problem was they didn't have depth charges, so you had to attack a surfaced U-boat with bombs, except for the Sunderlands. The other thing they would do is they would have the aircraft accompany convoys. Now, the main thing to remember about the war through June 1940 is the U-boat war was focused in the North Sea, the Norwegian Sea, and some of the North Atlantic on England's western shore, the western approaches. Because the U-boats were based in Germany, that was about as far as they could go. The other thing that the British did in the first month of the war is they sent aircraft carrier Hunter Killer groups after the submarines. Again, the problem was they had to use fleet carriers because they did not have escort carriers. I suppose they could have used the Argus for that, but they were essentially using the Argus for training. The Argus was a World War I era aircraft carrier, but the problem was they were using these very expensive fleet carriers. They really had not developed good anti-submarine tactics, and one of the two carriers that was being used on this duty ended up getting torpedoed and sunk, after which they decided that it was a bad idea. Because you could sink, you know, if you traded 3, 4, even 10 U-boats for one aircraft carrier, one fleet carrier, that was a bad rate of exchange. So yeah, those got withdrawn after literally 1 month, and the fleet air arm would not play a role in the Battle of the Atlantic until really 1941. Except for land-based squadrons, which included a number of swordfish that were operating out of Gibraltar.
And with the fall of France and the U-boats moving to French bases, the Bay of Biscay became a battleground for transiting in and out.
Well, that actually didn't happen until really 1942.
Okay.
But the whole point of both the Norwegian and the French bases was that it expanded the scope of the battle, whereas right, Coastal Command was just getting a handle on the U-boats up until the fall of France, despite the fact they really didn't have the tools to attack the U-boats. They were at least effective in forcing the U-boats to remain submerged. And a submerged U-boat finds it very difficult to attack anything. That's one of the paradoxes of submarine warfare. The U-boat is virtually blind when it's submerged, and at that point, it's literally a mobile mine. The way the Germans were using them was on the surface hunting for both individual ships and convoys. So, again, the point was that Coastal Command had the situation almost under control when all of a sudden the battlefield they had to cover tripled or perhaps quadrupled in size, and Britain was on its, you know, back leg because they were being threatened with invasion, and literally all of the resources from, say, July 1940 until September or October were being sucked into making sure that Germany didn't invade England. So the U-boats ran wild.
Yeah.
Even after that, they experienced what was called the first happy time, because there simply weren't enough aircraft to go around.
And that expansion of the air war to, you know, as far north as Iceland and Greenland and as far south as Gibraltar, you reflect in the first of your books, which covers the 39-41 era, and the capture of U-boat 570 by Hudson's from, was that Iceland?
Iceland, it was Iceland.
Yeah, and it was a mixture of aircraft types. I think two Hudsons and a Catalina managed to combine to eventually get the U-boat to surface and surrender.
Right. That was an interesting case. Finally, that occurred because finally by January 1941, the British had a 250-pound depth charge. All of a sudden, the Coastal Command aircraft, except for the Anson, were capable of sinking a U-boat, all of them. And what ended up happening was, by that point, the British had stationed several squadrons of aircraft in Iceland. It wasn't just the Hudsons. They had a Catalina squadron there. They had some single-engine Northrop float planes that were originally sold to Norway and were being operated by the Free Norwegian Air Forces. So Iceland, at that point, Iceland was about as far west as the U-boats were operating. They did not want to operate further west for fear of bringing the United States into the war. So the British put a lot of their air assets, well, some air assets, in Iceland. And during one of those patrols, U-570, which was a Type 7 U-boat, it was pretty much at the edge of its operational radius, ended up being attacked by a Hudson and damaged, and it had submerged, and the attack forced it to the surface, and the crew, they couldn't resubmerge. They were stuck on the surface. And it was a fairly inexperienced crew. And basically, when they came out, they started waving white T-shirts, towels, whatever, to indicate that they'd surrendered. And the two Hudsons continued circling, reported what had happened. And the British sent out some ships to recover the thing. But the submarine surrendered to the aircraft. The Catalina came along later to make sure that U-70 didn't sneak off, because they were, at that point, they were concerned that the Hudsons would run out of fuel before the surface ships arrived. But it was an extraordinary episode, because who would expect a submarine to surrender to aircraft? And, you know, to an extent, the aircraft crews had to be commended for not giving in to the temptation of sinking the U-boat on the grounds of the bird in the hand. The submarine was eventually commissioned in the Royal Navy as HMS Graf and was used to hunt other U-boats.
Ah, I didn't know that. And the war was expanding, as you said, as far south as places like Gibraltar, and also in the book you talk about the first strike using radar to locate a U-boat,
right.
and this time it was Fleet Air Arm Swordfish seconded to Coastal Command.
Right. The British ended up losing most of their aircraft carriers. They weren't sunk, but they were damaged. And while they were under repair, they had offloaded the squadrons at Gibraltar, where they were used for anti-submarine. Now, at that point, Gibraltar also had a Catalina squadron and some other anti-submarine aircraft. However, these Swordfish were equipped with Mark I radar systems, and they would conduct patrols at night. And in one case, they found U-451. Now, one of the problems with a night attack using radar, especially with the Mark I, is the closer you got to the target, all of a sudden it would fill the screen with snow. So when you were using it, you were essentially searching a donut area around you, with the area closest to you being invisible. The thing is, during daylight, of course, you could see the U-boat. Even at night, if there was a full moon, the U-boat left a large wake that was spotted, and you could track. What the Swordfish were doing, they were carrying flares. So they would get over the area where the U-boat was, they'd drop the flares, then they'd circle around using the illumination of the flares to make their final attack on the U-boat. That's what happened in this case. They surprised the U-boat on the surface. They dropped the flares, lit up the night, and then came around and dropped a couple of depth charges on the U-boat and sank it. And it was the first confirmed kill of a U-boat. Now, several months earlier, a shore-based Coastal Command airplane had managed to hit and damage a U-boat in the Bay of Biscay, because by that time they were running patrols over the Bay of Biscay. But that was the limitation of the early radars. Finally, in 1942, they introduced, or late 1941, they introduced the Mark III radars, which were very accurate.
And Mark, as that sort of early phase of the jousting between the U-boats and Coastal Command and Fleet Air Arm in the air war came about, there appeared to be a drop in the tonnage sunk by the U-boats towards the end of this period. Was that down to the success of Coastal Command and Allied aircraft tactics?
Very definitely. By the end of 1941, the British had done essentially what they had done by the end of June 1940, which was bring the U-boats under control. And that included a massive convoy battle that was fought in December, where a convoy was escorted by a escort carrier. And during the battle, the Germans threw every submarine that they had available and virtually all the aircraft. At that point, they were using the Focke-Wulf 200s. And at the end of the battle, twice as many U-boats had been sunk as British ships had been sunk. Unfortunately, one of the ships that was sunk was the aircraft carrier Audacity. The other thing is that the British by that time had one squadron of Liberators that were operating out of Northern Ireland, and they escorted the convoy from about the middle of the Bay of Biscay into Liverpool. And just the appearance of the Liberator ended up driving the U-boats underwater. So the one of the paradoxes of it was that they'd achieved what by December 1941, they had achieved what they thought they were going to do in August or July of 1939. They'd brought the U-boats under control.
I was just going to say, an under control led to a significant change in tactics from both sides of the war as well. Technology was starting to support the Allied side, but the U-boats started to change tactics. I mean, Dönitz started to think about how he could use his U-boats in a different way as it sort of entered that 41-42 phase. And of course, by this time, the United States of America had entered the fray.
Right. And again, one of the paradoxes of the Battle of the Atlantic was Dönitz had developed what were called Wolfpack tactics, where you set out a line of U-boats to capture to discover a convoy on its way inbound or outbound, and then they would bring all the U-boats together and they would start attacking as a group. He had developed that prior to World War II. However, in the first stages of the war, they didn't need to do it. Basically because Coastal Command was completely ineffective. They had started doing it in 1941, about mid-41, and they were fairly effective. The tactics were fairly effective. Part of the problem was the Germans never had enough U-boats in the opening stages of the war. Now the United States enters the war. And the thing is, the British were beginning to deal with the Wolfpack tactics. But again, the battlefield doubles. You not only have to fight in the eastern half of the Atlantic, now you have to cover the western half of the Atlantic, the Caribbean, and the South Atlantic. Now, part of the thing with U-boats is you can't sink ships unless you are where the ships are. And for the first 2 years of the war, that was essentially Eastern Atlantic. Now you've got the happy hunting ground along the American coast. The paradox was the Germans couldn't use wolf pack tactics off the American coast or in the Caribbean because it was at the extreme range of their U-boats. So they went back to the tactics they'd been happily using in the winter of 1940, which was having individual submarines hunting in patrol areas. And they ended up massacring the ships off the American coast because, well, it turned out the United States was every bit as prepared to fight U-boats by air as Britain had been in 1939. And it took the United States roughly the same amount of time as the British did to get their act together, which was about 6 months. So for those 6 months, from about February 1942, because it took the Germans literally 2 months to get their U-boats deployed off the Atlantic coast, but from February 42 until July, I'm not going to say that Coastal Command was out of a job because they still had an important role to play. But the Germans did what they always did, which was take their U-boats away from the high concentration of aircraft. Yeah. So in some ways, Coastal Command's success made it less relevant in that phase of the war.
Yeah, and you know, as the war expanded on the western side of the Atlantic, as you know, Greenland, Iceland, and the belief that because America had entered the war, they were effectively covered, all it did was spread the battle over a greater expanse.
Right. Now, that favored the Germans in some ways, but it also disfavored them because they were operating at ranges beyond which the U-boats were intended to operate. I mean, Iceland, hey, that was well within their operational reach from French bases. With the United States, the only U-boats that could successfully reach the Atlantic coast of the U.S. were their large cruiser U-boats, the Type 9, and only a third of their boats were these nine boats. Two-thirds of them were the Type 7s, which were being concentrated against the convoy routes in the northern Atlantic that ran from Canada to England. Those were also the boats that had been used against the convoys going from England to Gibraltar or England around Africa.
G'day, I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
And Mark, they also deployed this tactic of the milk cows as well, using U-boats to refuel them, didn't they?
Right. They started the war with four very large mine-laying U-boats. And during 1942, they realized, hey, we can use these things to refuel and resupply the fighting U-boats. And they would set up rendezvous in parts of the Atlantic that could not be reached by aircraft. And at that time, that included most of the central Atlantic. Once you were south of about 500, 600 miles south of Iceland, the British had squadrons in Bermuda. But at that time, there wasn't anything in the Azores. The Azores wouldn't come about until 1943-44. So there were these big areas of the Atlantic where you couldn't get Coastal Command aircraft or even U.S. aircraft over. And one of the things that really crippled Coastal Command was the lack of what were called very long-range maritime patrol aircraft, such as the Liberators. The RAF was very, very focused on strategic bombing, and they were very reluctant to release four-engine aircraft for use by Coastal Command, even though these were the most effective aircraft that Coastal Command had. The other thing that with those aircraft is they were not only equipped with radar by 1942, but they were also equipped with something called the lay light, which was a very powerful spotlight. And instead of dropping flares, they would use the radar to track the U-boat, and then at the last minute they'd turn on the lay light to illuminate the U-boat and attack it that way. So that's actually the cover image of the second book.
It's a great photo, and hopefully I'll be able to put a link to that in the show notes. Mark, one question: as the battle expanded to fill literally the whole of the Atlantic, how did Coastal Command and the U.S. Army Air Force, as it originally was, but the U.S. Navy as well, how did they work together to effectively fight the German threat?
Well, very badly at first, and then they finally managed to coordinate. Part of the problem was the Army Air Force was more interested in strategic bombing than they were in maritime patrol. They had pretty much no capability at the beginning of the war. The Navy was not permitted multi-engine aircraft at the beginning of the war, except for flying boats. So the Navy had developed Catalinas, Mariners, and they had some four-engine flying boats that they could also use, but they weren't allowed to use land-based aircraft. When 1942 continued, one, the Army Air Force began losing interest in it and allowing the Navy to take over. Two, the various nations that were involved, Britain, Canada, the United States, and then ultimately Brazil, set up areas of responsibility. The United States ultimately took charge of anti-submarine warfare in the southern half of the North Atlantic Ocean, while the British took care of the northern half of the Atlantic, and the Canadians focused on the area, the Canadian Air Forces focused on the northwestern part of the North Atlantic from Greenland west to the Canadian coast. So the air war ends up with Coastal Command spending most of its resources in the coldest part of the North Atlantic, with the U.S. enjoying the tropics. The exception to that was the Azores, and this is where it gets really interesting, because Britain and Portugal had a treaty that dated prior to the current treaties. The more recent treaties that defined neutrality. And because of that treaty, Britain, but not the United States, could operate aircraft out of the Azores without compromising Portuguese neutrality. Very convoluted diplomacy. But for a while, the British were operating out of the Azores. In 1944, I think the United States began taking over there because Portugal essentially didn't care if Germany declared war on it. It's as I said, it was one of the stranger aspects of the air war. Plus, I think the British operated out of the Ascension Islands in the South Atlantic as well.
And with the change in tactics from the U-boats, where they in effect operated individually rather than they still hunted in packs and were brought to attack convoys, particularly in the North Atlantic.
Right.
But as they split up into individual units, particularly across the US coastline, their way of targeting shipping changed, didn't it? Because it was all about tonnage to Dönitz. It was how many ships he sunk. But the reality was, hunting on their own, they were picking off single ships rather than the convoys that they were attacking in the early part of the war.
Well, actually, even in the early part of the war, they were trying to attack individual ships. The British convoys broke up well east of Iceland initially. They did not have convoys going from coast to coast until probably late 1941, from the Atlantic, from the North America to England, until 1941.
Yeah.
And part of the whole reason behind the Wolfpack tactics was to try and get the convoys to break up, and then they would attack the stragglers and the individual ships. The main virtue of a convoy is that it clusters a whole bunch of ships in a very small area. And since the only way the U-boats could find ships was by visually spotting them from the U-boat, essentially every U-boat could only search a 15-mile disc around the U-boat, and only when it was surfaced. So these lines of U-boats were spread about, 20 miles apart in order to catch the convoy. Now, if you had the convoys eventually ended up as 90 ships, because they discovered the bigger the convoy, the fewer opportunities the Germans had to even find them. But if you had 90 ships sailing individually, the odds that you would find one of those ships, if you were a U-boat captain, was a lot higher than if all 90 of them were in one spot. And whether you've got 90 ships in one spot or one ship in, you really can only attack two or three ships anyway.
Yeah.
So this is something a lot of people miss about the convoys, is simply having them was effective against a lone U-boat. That was the reason that Dönitz had developed the Wolf Pack, because if you could bring, say, 10 U-boats against that convoy, and each one of them sank one to three ships, you've got a massacre. And actually, I don't think there were any convoys other than perhaps PQ-17, which broke up, where you ended up losing more than 15 ships.
Yeah.
But you're right, it was a tonnage war.
And one of the threats that was very effective was providing air cover. And with the middle part of that war and the very long-range aircraft, the Liberator in particular, but other aircraft like the B-17 and some English aircraft, Coastal Command could stretch itself further towards that mid-Atlantic gap, couldn't it? And that started to put keep the U-boats, in effect, away.
Right. That's kind of what I meant when I said that Coastal Command played a less important role in the Battle of the Atlantic, because they were so effective. Because the Germans didn't want to fight the aircraft. They were trying to find the areas where the aircraft weren't. The other thing that Coastal Command did that was very, very effective during that period is they essentially set up a blockade in the Bay of Biscay, where they would have continual patrols catching the U-boats before they reached the convoys. And that was very effective. One, it forced the U-boats to stay submerged in the Bay of Biscay. Two, any U-boat that you could sink going to a convoy was a U-boat that wasn't going to attack the convoy. And three, U-boats ended up using a lot more fuel if they were forced to submerge than if they cruised on the surface. So, they were it was effective in several ways. And then the British learned that the Germans had a radar detector aboard their U-boats. They discovered this when they suddenly stopped sinking U-boats. So what they did was they started just having continuous aircraft flying over the area, making sure that all of the bay was covered by radar, because every time the Germans detected the radar, they would submerge. So even if they weren't sinking anything, they were degrading the German ability to attack. And then they went to the centimeter wave radar, which the German radar detectors could not pick up. And what was even better about that is a Coastal Command aircraft pilot ended up being captured and convinced the Germans that the reason that they were being spotted was because the British were homing in on the radar detectors.
It was cat and mouse, wasn't it? It was cat and mouse.
Right, right.
And technology was creeping in more and more to Coastal Command aircraft. You talked about the radar. We went from the Mark II to the Mark III. But we also saw the introduction of the homing torpedo as well.
Right. There were new weapons that emerged in really the late winter of 1943. The three weapons were the Fido homing torpedo, the rocket. They had these 5-inch rockets that were literally traveled at supersonic speeds, that were, you know, essentially a return to the medieval spear, and it hit with enough kinetic energy to go right through the hull of a U-boat. And of course, the escort carriers finally started arriving. And it was the combination of those three that really shut down the U-boat offensive. The U-boats in May 1943, everything came together, and the Allies sank a total of 43 U-boats. That was, and since the Germans had about, they had about 200 total U-boats that were operational at that time. That's a heck of a loss to take. And Dönitz ended up withdrawing the U-boats for a month and then trying again. But from there on out, they were losing a lot more U-boats than the Allies were losing merchant ships.
Is this what you describe as the deadly month of May?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
And this really shifted the tactics, didn't it, completely?
I think the tactics had already shifted by that point, or at least the Allied tactics. What happened in May was the result of the maturation of the tactics that they had been developing through 1942. There were some other things going on as well. One thing was that the Allies had cracked the German Enigma code really in 1940. And through much of 1940-41, they were reading the Germans' mail, because Dönitz's concept required a lot of radio communications in order to coordinate the U-boats. So, you know, we knew where the U-boats were, we knew what they were going to do, and on top of Enigma, we were also using radio direction finding to pinpoint the location of U-boats. But then in 1940, early 1942, the Germans went to a four-rotor Enigma machine for the U-boats, and there was a communications blackout for a good 9 months, definitely a pregnant pause. And it wasn't until 1943 that we were again reading the message traffic. And the thing is that if you know where your enemy is going to be, you know where to put your resources. So it's like I said, everything combined to work against the U-boats. And the real problem was that the U-boats had no real defense against aircraft. They developed homing torpedoes of their own to take out the escorts, but a U-boat was pretty impotent against an aircraft. The Germans attempted to set up flak boats, where they had a U-boat that was heavily armed with anti-aircraft guns. And that turned out to be an absolute disaster, because what the aircraft would do at that point is, if they detected a U-boat and it didn't submerge, they'd assume it was a flak trap, and they'd call in other aircraft. And then when you got four or five of them together, they would essentially surround the U-boat, and then, like something out of a Western, with the Indians attacking from all directions, they would come into the U-boat from all directions, and the U-boat couldn't deal with all of the attackers, and eventually one would land a depth charge or a bomb on the U-boat or a missile, and you had one fewer U-boat.
Yeah. As the war moved into its final stage, you talk about the tide turning in the book, and there's a really, really interesting statement I thought was fascinating, where you said the Allies couldn't believe that they'd won the Battle of Atlantic and the Germans couldn't believe they lost, so they just continued slogging it out, in effect. But the reality was, with more long-range aircraft coming into coastal command, and also from the western sides of the Atlantic as well, the pincer movement was always going to have an inevitable ending.
Right. The thing is, the Germans tried some technology to try and counter the Allies. One was the first one was the snorkel, which allowed the U-boat to run its diesel engines while submerged, and the only thing that radar would pick up would be the snorkel head, which was sticking above the water to suck in air. The snorkel had several very real limitations. One of them was that the submarine could not travel at more than about 7 knots or destroy the snorkel. On the surface, they would cruise at 15 knots. The other problem with the snorkel was it left the U-boat deaf and blind. A U-boat operating under its electric motors had hydrophones to listen for approaching enemies. A U-boat under operating with a snorkel, the diesel engine drowned out any other sound. So if you had a British destroyer group in the area, they would pick up the submarine on sonar and be able to attack it without the submarine being aware that there were ships in the area. Again, there's sort of a paradox here in that what protects you against aircraft makes you more vulnerable to ships. And the other thing about the Battle of the Atlantic was it was very definitely a combined arms operation. No one element would have succeeded. If you'd relied entirely on aircraft, the Germans could have found a way around it. If you had relied entirely on ships, you wouldn't have been able to find the U-boat.
Fascinating. Fascinating, yep. Conundrum. Just to sum up this element of our discussion then, Mark, what contribution do you think Coastal Command had to the outcome of the overall war?
Oh, in many ways, Coastal Command was the reason that we won. We didn't win because of Coastal Command. We won because we occupied Germany. The Coastal Command allowed Britain to receive the supplies that it needed to stay in the war and to supply the armies that eventually landed in Northern Europe. Without Coastal Command, Britain would have lost World War II, and actually, because Coastal Command was so starved of resources, they very nearly did. The first 2 years had Britain been prepared and had a Coastal Command with effective weapons, the first 2 years of the Battle of the Atlantic would have been very much like the last year. And we may never have had a massive U-boat war because the Germans were expecting the U-boats not to work out and had very few, and initially had not planned on building very many. But once they discovered how effective their U-boats were, they went into a massive building campaign, eventually building well over 1,000 U-boats. But again, most of those arrived after the Royal Air Force had gotten its act together, giving Coastal Command the tools that it needed, and eventually gave it the aircraft that it needed. And once that happened, I'm pretty well sure there's no way the Germans could have won the Battle of the Atlantic, despite the fears that were often expressed by those on the Allied side fighting it. And again, I understand why they were so worried about it, because their pre-war expectations ended up being tipped into a trash can by the first year of the war.
Fascinating stuff. Thank you, Mark.
Hi, Mick Oakey here, Managing Editor of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. Just as Extended is currently expanding your knowledge of RAF Coastal Command, you might be keen to widen your aviation history horizons in other directions as well. Did you know, for example, that around the time the Short Sunderland was entering RAF service, Shorts were breaking with their flying boat traditions and planning a long-range advanced land plane airliner? The project was halted on the outbreak of war, but you can read all about it in our latest edition, TAH 37. Did you also know about the British South Africa Police Reserve Air Wing, established in 1957, in which farmers and businessmen flew anti-guerrilla missions in their own civilian light aircraft, fitted with door-mounted machine guns and homemade grenade chutes? Or that Italy's mighty Isotta Fraschini Asso 750 aero engine, an 18-cylinder broad-arrow monster introduced in the early 1930s, which developed 850 horsepower, is still in production as a marine engine today, 90 years later? You can read in depth about all of this in issue 37 of The Aviation Historian and extend your knowledge. We're print, we're digital, but we're not on sale in newsagents. Order us online and find out more at theaviationhistorian.com.
So that's chapter 3, covering RAF Coastal Command's role in the battle for the Atlantic. In the next chapter, we'll look at the role of RAF Coastal Command's strike wings. Look out for this episode in a few weeks' time. We would like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show. We would also like to thank the extended family of supporters, including Mick Oakey at The Aviation Historian and Dave Homewood at the Wings Over New Zealand podcast. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website, and please do ask before you use anything you hear. The programme is produced with a Creative Commons licence. You can find me at Gareth_Stringer on Twitter, and you can find Ellie, Tim and Peter on the extended Twitter, Facebook and Instagram feeds. Please leave us some feedback on this series and engage with us to debate the role of Coastal Command. And with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from me, Gareth Stringer. But remember, stay tuned into this frequency. It is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station, Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
The cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
Just taking me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Knowing how to recognise a storm, being taught like visually and the basic PPL, it wouldn't bother me.
Thanks for listening to Extended. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need. Extended.
This is XTP Media.